Millions of Iranians take to the streets in nationwide rallies to condemn the U.S. hostilities against their country. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi tells his U.S. counterpart that Iran was freed 43 years ago after Joe Biden said on Thursday that we're going to free Iran. And also, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams Israeli regime's latest attack on the besieged Gaza Strip, calling it a blatant violation. Our top story for this half hour today is a very important day in Iran's history. It's named the National Day Against Global Arrogance, and Iranians commemorate the occasion by holding rallies to condemn U.S. policies. Crowds of people took to the streets in different cities in a show of their anger at the U.S. atrocities directed at their country over the past four decades. In the capital, Tehran, the protesters gathered just outside a building that used to be the U.S. Embassy before the Islamic Revolution. 43 years ago on this day, a group of university students took over the U.S. Embassy, which they believed had turned into a center of espionage following the country's 1979 Islamic Revolution. After the takeover, students published documents of U.S. Embassy involvement in plans to overthrow the Islamic Republic. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says the United States is on the top of the list of countries that have committed crimes against other nations. Ebrahim Raisi was addressing a large crowd of people gathered in Tehran to commemorate the anniversary of the U.S. embassy takeover by Iranian students. He said the U.S. has been involved in over 300 wars and 62 coups under the pretext of liberating nations. He told his U.S. counterpart that Iran was freed 43 years ago after Joe Biden said on Thursday that we're going to free Iran. Raisi said the Islamic Republic has been pursuing its fight against global arrogance since its foundation. He added if the U.S. embassy had not been seized by Iranian students, fighting against global arrogance would have been incomplete. Activist and political analyst Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi says the United States has been pursuing its anti-Iran policies for decades.
They have done 70 years of animosity against Iran and Iranian people, and now they are blaming Iran. And I believe what Malcolm X said more than six decades ago about America and American policies is still valid. No expiry for those words. American democracy is hypocrisy. This is what Malcolm X said. And it is exact taking place at that time when Malcolm X was fighting for the rights of the civil rights of the black people in America, and he was telling that we are the victims, and now we are being accused by the system in America. And then he said that, you know, golden rule, American democracy is hypocrisy. And the same is still going on. Look at it. America is doing all this, you know, evil acts against the people of the rest of the world, what they call to be themselves, the rest of the world, not actually the rest of the world, the rest of the world are those who are being victimized by America and American policy. And then as pointing towards Iran and blaming Iran and, you know, making propaganda against Iran by the hands of the media. The same as I said at the very beginning of my point.
Our correspondent Gisu Misha Ahmadi spoke with one of the protesters at the rally in Tehran about the significance of today.
Okay, so please tell us why 13th of Aban, the 13th of Aban demonstrations are important.
So on the actual 13th of Aban, a couple of different events happened, which all are related to anti-America. And this even goes back before the Islamic Revolution. So Death to America didn't came after the Islamic Revolution, it came before. It came after the U.S. Supported to topple the democratic government, before even Islamic Republic, which Mossadegh was in charge. So students came to protest the visit of the president and they were massacred. So therefore we call this day Students' Day. And it's a day that we remember anti-America sort of protest.
Now, considering the recent developments in Iran and the riots that are being supported by the U.S. and its Western allies, why is it even more important for people to take part in the demonstrations this year?
So when a riot happens, sometimes the enemies of Iran, especially America, Israel, Britain, they think, okay, Iran's getting weaker. Well, this is the hope that they've had for more than 40 years. And look, every single year, younger, I was born after the revolution. Look at these students here. They were even born 10, 15, 20 years after me, and they're still here. So this shows, this year's sort of rally, it shows that we are never, never tired, and we will be resisting. And we, Iran, at the moment, at current at the time, is the most strongest in its history. And as we go ahead, this is going to increase and increase and increase. So you don't wait until you see this Islamic revolution, Islamic Republic is going to go away. It's not going to go away.
Iran has once again rejected the allegations that it provided Russia with weapons to be used in Ukraine, reiterating Tehran's preparedness to help end the conflict. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani stated that emotional comments and baseless accusations will not solve the Ukraine crisis. Kanani urged Ukrainian officials to respond to Iran's call for holding technical meetings with Kiev's military experts on the issue of drones. This is in reaction to Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba, who accused Iran of supplying arms to Russia. Tehran has already said it's ready for talks with Ukraine to clear things up. Iran has also called for an end to the war in Ukraine, urging restraint on both sides. Well, the United States confirms that it has sent soldiers to Ukraine. That's while Russia has repeatedly warned that Washington's involvement in the Ukraine war risks direct confrontation with Moscow. And Ron Mazzari has more from Chicago.
The Pentagon has admitted that the United States has soldiers on the ground in the Ukraine and far from their embassy, a decision which drastically increases the chances of accidentally sparking an all-out war with Russia. The troops are allegedly only inspecting and doing a proper accounting of U.S. arms deliveries to Ukraine, but many have alleged that their actual role is to provide weapons training and perhaps more. The United States has already provided nearly $20 billion worth of military equipment to Ukraine this year. Both Republican leaders and some progressive Democrats have openly criticized the costly aid, which has only further escalated the conflict. It has already been widely reported that scores of U.S. ex-military personnel and retired officers are helping to lead the war from inside Ukraine. The Pentagon claims the so-called inspectors will not travel to the front lines, but that gives many little comfort.
I think they're acting very recklessly, and they're dragging us to something that could be completely avoided now that you have, you know, Russia saying, hey, we'll use nukes if you don't back off, right? And I think this isn't a war between, you know, Ukraine and the United States. This isn't a war between Ukraine and Russia. It's a war between NATO using Ukraine as a proxy to weaken Russia.
Washington has known for months that their weapons shipments went totally untraced once they entered into Ukraine. Not only does that facilitate Defense Department mismanagement and possible corruption, but the arms could wind up in the hands of far-right militias and be used to destabilize the area for years, as NATO weapons did in the Balkans and then Libya. U.S. weapons have already been found to have been illicitly diverted to Sweden, Denmark, and as far away as the Netherlands.
When you have the United States, when you have the Pentagon saying, hey, we're going to post all these long-range missiles on your border, Ukraine, so that you can reach Moscow in 6 minutes, obviously Russia is going to do something about it. So I think the United States foreign policy right now is essentially pouring billions into Ukraine, pouring like billions into mercenaries, pouring billion into this proxy war in order to weaken Russia.
With the U.S. kicked out of Afghanistan, illegally occupying northeastern Syria, and precariously perched in Iraq, many wonder if Washington and NATO have chosen the Ukraine for their new theater of war. Anti-NATO demonstrations across Europe have been violently repressed in recent weeks. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed the Israeli regime's latest attack on the Gaza Strip. The movement described the airstrikes as a blatant violation, the continuation of the regime's war against the Palestinians. It said Tel Aviv will not be able to stand in the way of people's revolution by such acts of terrorism. Israeli warplanes targeted the Gaza Strip in the early hours of Friday. No casualties or damage have been reported. The Israeli regime has raided the besieged territory numerous times this year. It usually justifies such attacks as being a response to rockets fired from Gaza. And doctors treating former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan say that he's in stable condition and is doing fine a day after his assassination attempt. Imran Khan is being treated at a hospital in the eastern city of Lahore. He was injured on Thursday after an attack on his convoy left him with a gunshot wound in his right leg. The attack also left one person dead and 10 others wounded. Several leaders of Khan's Tehrik-e-Insaf party have blamed the government for the assassination attempt, which the authorities have denied.
An attack on the convoy of ousted Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan wounded him and several of his supporters who were marching towards Islamabad demanding early elections. Police said that a gunman opened fire at the campaign truck carrying Imran Khan, wounding him slightly. Since his ouster in a parliamentary no-confidence vote in April, Khan has been alleging that his dismissal was a conspiracy engineered by his successor Shahbaz Sharif and the United States. The PTI leadership has directly blamed Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and a high-ranking military official for carrying out the assassination attempt.
We demand that these three men should be removed from their posts. If these people are not removed from their positions, then there will be nationwide protests.
While asking Imran Khan's supporters to stop the blame game, the government has assured every possible support for holding high-profile inquiry into the assassination attempt.
The incident is very unfortunate and condemnable, but it should not be politicized, and speculations on this incident must be avoided.
Political experts believe that the attack on the PTI party chief will trigger further political instability and chaos in the country.
I think in the days to come, the Pakistani political atmosphere will be more charged. It will be more violent. This gun attack on Khan will definitely change Pakistan's political scenario.
The attack on the former Pakistani premier also sparked countrywide protest and international contaminations.
The attack on the former Pakistani Prime Minister has further fueled the ongoing political tensions. It is highly believed that more confrontations would be witnessed in days to come in the country's political arena. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
2 decades of U.S. war in Afghanistan has killed many Afghan people. Although the U.S. withdrew its forces from Afghanistan in 2021, the devastating aftermath of the war is still pervasive in Afghan society. Security is still not restored, and many are in constant danger. That includes Afghan journalists who risk their lives on a daily basis to bring the latest to the people.
A new report by the Afghan Journalistic Center shows that at least 127 journalists and media workers lost their lives during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Investigations also show that in more than 90% of those cases, the ones responsible for the deaths were not brought to justice. The Association of Afghan Reporters is demanding the International Criminal Court to take a look into the killings. People are also asking the Taliban to stay true to what it has promised and show support towards Afghan journalists. That includes ending impunity for crimes against this group of workers who are constantly under danger in a war-torn country.
The U.S. started the war on Afghanistan and caused devastation and casualties. It should be held accountable for the death of all civilians, especially journalists, in the past 20 years. The International Criminal Court should investigate the killing cases of Afghan journalists and recognize them as international crimes. The families of slain journalists should be paid compensation. Unfortunately, so far, not a single case has been inspected.
This comes as those 127 martyred journalists have been two honest and dedicated staff, Said Farhad Takaddousi and Habibullah Hussainzadeh, who lost their lives on duty in 2011 and 2017. The relatives and colleagues of the two continue to honor their memory.
Two of our colleagues at Press TV were among the victims of U.S. war on Afghanistan. Syed Farhad in 2011 and Habibullah was martyred in 2017, both on duty and in war incidents. They were so close to me and meant a lot for Press TV and the medium community in Afghanistan. Their loss should not be forgotten or ignored. We demand justice and compensation for their families.
The commemoration of martyrs comes as the Afghanistan situation is still tense for journalists. Rights bodies are calling for support and protection by the ruling Taliban and the international community. Due to war and insecurity, Afghanistan has been one of the most dangerous countries for reporters. And there have been journalists like Press TV's martyrs who gave their lives in the line of duty. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
North Korea has fired a barrage of artillery rounds into a maritime border zone with the neighboring South in another defiance of warnings from Washington and Seoul. The new move follows the launch of nearly two dozen ballistic missiles by Pyongyang since Wednesday. That's in response to the largest ever joint air drills by the U.S. and South Korea, which have now announced extending beyond Friday. Pyongyang, however, warned that Seoul and Washington made a, quote, very risky decision. By extending their war games, tensions are running high on the Korean Peninsula as the North has test-fired a record number of missiles this year. South Korean officials have said that Seoul will respond to any provocation from Pyongyang and that they are tracking the North's movements in close cooperation with the U.S. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we started explanation of Surah Hashr, which is number 59 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It has 24 ayahs and was revealed in Medina. Its name is derived from the second ayah, which mentions the word Hashr, which does not, however, denote the gathering on the day of resurrection, but it connotes people's gathering for migration. The surah opens and closes with the glorification of God Almighty by all that is in the world of existence. It mainly refers to the collaboration of the Arab hypocrites with the Israelite tribes in Medina against the Muslims, and the banishment of the Jewish tribe of Banu Nadir for its breaking of the agreement with the Prophet. The Almighty Creator says that the joint stratagems of the hypocrites and the rebellious Israelites lead to nothing but their humiliation and defeat. If you remember last Friday, in explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said the believers are not awed by the strength of the enemies, whether hypocrites or disbelievers, and they act with full trust in God, with alertness and vigilance against the stratagems of the enemies, without giving them a chance to cause further harm. Now, let us listen to ayahs 6 and 7 of the surah.
وَمَا أَفَاءَ اللَّهُ عَلَى رَسُولِهِ مِنْهُمْ فَمَا أَوْجَفْتُمْ عَلَيْهِ مِنْ خَيْلٍ وَلَا رِكَابٍ وَلَكِنَّ اللَّهَ يُسَلِّطُ رُسُلَهُ عَلَى مَنْ يَشَاءُ وَاللَّهُ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ ما أفاء الله على رسوله من أهل القرى فلله وللرسول ولذي القربى واليتامى والمساكين وابن السبيل كي لا يكون دولة بين الأغنياء منكم وَمَا آتَاكُمُ الرَّسُولُ فَخُذُوهُ وَمَا نَهَاكُمْ عَنْهُ فَانْتَهُوا وَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ إِنَّ اللَّهَ شَدِيدُ الْعِقَابِ
Whatever Allah restored to His Prophet from them, and you neither spared any horse for its sake, nor any riding camel, but Allah makes His prophets prevail over whomever He wishes. And Allah has power over all things. And whatever Allah has restored to His prophet from the people of the townships are for Allah and the prophet, and for relatives and the orphans, and the destitute and the traveler, so that they do not circulate among the rich amongst you. And take whatever the Prophet gives you, and relinquish whatever he forbids you, and be wary of Allah. Indeed, Allah is severe in retribution. Whatever is in the heavens and the earth and between them is created by Allah and belongs to Him, although by religious or civil law, people may be in possession of some worldly things as trustees or owners, But when they become disbelievers and turn hostile towards the truth, they lose all rights over these properties. Hence, the use of the word and the phrase Allah restored to his prophet. Consequently, when these properties have come into the possession of the prophet peacefully, without the Muslims making any efforts or fighting the disbelievers as a jihad, these are not classified as anfal or spoils for distribution amongst the warriors, regarding which also the authority of the prophet is unchallengeable. As for uncultivated lands, mountains, reed beds, and rivers, which as per the ayah of the Noble Quran fall without military engagement into the disposal of the Prophet, such property will be distributed upon the Prophet's discretion among certain groups of people, like the poor, the orphans, the stranded, the deserving kindred, and those Muslim immigrants who had lost their properties in Mecca. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, at times victory is gained without fighting because of divine assistance and the awe that God instills in the hearts of the disbelievers. Number two, the Islamic economic system is based on just distribution of wealth so that it is not put exclusively in the hands of a special group or stratum. And number three, whatever the Prophet bids or forbids is in accordance with the command of God and should be obeyed. We present you ayahs 8 and 9 of the same surah.
للفقراء المهاجرين الذين أخرجوا من ديارهم وأموالهم يبتغون فضلا من الله ورضوانا وينصرون الله ورسوله أولئك هم الصادقون والذين تبوأوا الدار والإيمان من قبلهم يحبون من هاجر إليهم ولا يجدون في صدورهم حاجة مما أوتوا ويؤثرون على أنفسهم ولو كان بهم خصاصة وَمَنْ يُوقَ شُحَّ نَفْسِهِ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُفْلِحُونَ.
They are also for the poor emigrants who have been expelled from their homes and wrested of their possessions, who seek grace from Allah and His pleasure and help Allah and His Prophet. It is they who are the truthful. They are also for those who were settled in the land and abided in faith before them, who love those who migrate toward them and do not find in their breast any need for that which is given to them, but prefer the immigrants to themselves, though poverty be their own lot. And those who are saved from their own greed, it is they who are the felicitous. Ayah 9 means to say that the poor Muslim emigrants who had lost their possessions when they left their homes for Medina in order to preserve their faith for the sake of Allah are indeed truthful and deserve a share in the properties acquired from the disbelievers. Ayah 9 refers to the Ansar, which means helpers, that is the people of Medina who had accepted the truth of Islam prior to the Prophet's arrival and were waiting for him. They also have a share in the possessions acquired from the disbelievers, since they heartily welcomed the immigrants, Muslims of Mecca, hosted them in their houses, provided food for them, and helped them settle in Medina, even if they themselves were faced with poverty. They are indeed the felicitous. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, it is the duty of believers to assist their brethren in faith who have displaced from homes and help them settle in their new land. Poor believers beseech God for help and do not extend their hand before others, but it is the duty of the faithful to help them. Number three, those who are honest will not give up their faith even under economic pressure. And number four, abstinence from greed, jealousy, stinginess, and grudge are among the causes of perfection and will lead to salvation in the hereafter. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here is Ayah 10 of Surah Hashr.
وَالَّذِينَ جَاءُوا مِن بَعْدِهِمْ يَقُولُونَ رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لَنَا وَلِإِخْوَانِنَا الَّذِينَ سَبَقُونَا بِالْإِيمَانِ وَلَا تَجْعَلْ فِي قُلُوبِنَا غِلًّا لِلَّذِينَ آمَنُوا ربنا إنك رؤوف رحيم.
And also those who came after them, who say, Our Lord, forgive us, and our brethren who were our forerunners in the faith, and do not put any rancor in our hearts towards the faithful. Our Lord, you are indeed most kind and merciful. After classifying the emigrants and the helpers, this ayah refers to the third group of early Muslims who had embraced the truth of Islam later. They earnestly seek forgiveness from God Almighty for their previous life of aimlessness and have now wholeheartedly joined the ranks of believers. It is thus incumbent upon the Prophet to provide them a share as part of efforts for removing poverty from the society. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, boundaries of time and place are not important in religious brotherhood. Number two, faith in God and removal of all negative attitudes from the hearts makes a person deserving of divine mercy and kindness. And number three, sins are forgiven when repentance in the divine court is earnest and sincere.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping has been picked as the party's general secretary for a third time, which means that he will be the leader of China for another 5 years. In the 20th National Congress, the CPC, or Communist Party of China, highlighted its commitments to things like reducing inequality. That's a good cause. When it comes to hot-button issues like Taiwan, it refused to rule out the possibility of using force. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why China, or what China is going to do for the next 5 years and how that matters, especially at this point in time with the specter of the U.S. provoking it and drawing it into a war over a host of issues stands tall. Let me first introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us from Geneva is Peter Koenig. He's a geopolitical analyst and former World Bank economist. Welcome, Peter Koenig. And also we have from Detroit, Michigan, Haz Aldeen joining us. He's a political analyst and host of Infrared Show.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Peter Koenig, first I'll start with you. When we take a look at this next 5 years for Xi Jinping to have been picked, it's a good thing in terms of the commitments that he has given, in terms of things that he said he's going to cover, not only on the world scale but also domestically. But the way that the news is covered by some Western or many Western media outlets is he's holding on to power, extending his grip on power, surrounding himself with loyalists. Why do you think their take is different than the substance itself?
Thank you very much for having me. Well, I also think the re-election is a very good thing. It lends the country to more stability and continuity with the successful policy that he has certainly had in the past. We can talk about those too. I mean, what he has achieved. Now, the Western media, of course, and politicians, they have to criticize, they have to leave no good thing on China. So, but look at Madame Merkel, Germany's chancellor. She was in power for 16 years, was so-called re-elected four times, and nobody complained. The West applies different standards for what it perceives to be itself and her enemies. Now, the other thing that is also largely criticized, as you pointed out, that Xi Jinping surrounded himself with loyalists. Well, tell me one leader, including the U.S. and all of the Europeans and probably around the world, who doesn't set up a cabinet or a series of advisors that are not loyalists. I mean, this is normal. Any president does that, but why is it not correct if China does it? These are double standards, which I think we have to point out to the world and particularly to the media. So this is my take on these two issues. Now, if you like me to go into the achievements.
No, that's okay. We'll get into hopefully some of the areas that you deem also important on this. Hazeldeen, I'm going to go to a couple, or really I should say one topic that seems to be one of the focus of this of the agenda of Xi Jinping for the next 5 years, and based on what has been covered in his speech, bolstering security and turning China into a technological power is very important for China. Now, we're going to get into technological aspect of it a little later, but national security, high on the agenda and a priority. Why do you think that's cited as a priority in the eyes of Xi Jinping?
Well, as China has entered a new phase of its historical development, which is moving out of the primary stage of modernization and industrialization that characterized the reform and opening up era, China is starting to be recognized around the world as a serious geopolitical player and superpower. And with that has come the understanding on part of the Chinese leadership that that's going to lead to an increased level of aggression and hostility from the world's premier superpower, which is the United States. So China has to prioritize national security now in ways that it wasn't before, because it is increasingly finding itself in the crosshairs of the State Department and the foreign policy agenda of the United States.
National security and then technology. Peter Koenig, those two have been covered out of this conference synonymously at the same time. And it's very interesting, the reason for that, which based on just some of the research done, it seems like the technological aspect is somewhat tied into what the U.S. has done recently when it comes to the issue of chips. We know that they've restricted access to the Chinese when it comes to chips. Chips that, we know that they're for everyday appliances practically these days, but more importantly, it's used in the military arena. And the conclusion is that the U.S. is trying to prevent China from advancing in that field. Why do you think the U.S. wants to prevent China from advancing in that field?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure this can be taken seriously. I think this is more Biden's or the U.S. administration's bluff vis-a-vis the rest of the world. China is very much advanced in technology, in chip technology, and so on. China has almost all, if not all, of the raw materials, which means the rare earths that are needed for these technological approaches. So China has the capacity to be on its own. And that's why I wonder what is behind that. Of course, China needs to build up its military, and that is very clear. You pointed it out. You pointed out the reasons, and I agree with them. Especially, I mean, there is more going on. There's NATO encroaching on China from all sides, particularly the South China Sea. And conflicts are brewing everywhere in order to restrain China. So it is very logical that China has to build up, and does, has been doing so for the past 2 years. Its army and its technological advances in the military, while maintaining, and I would like to stress that, while maintaining a peaceful approach to what they call the modernization of China, actually the new direction that they're going into by reaching out to the global south. But as far as the U.S. so-called sanctions is concerned, they sound and read like terrific. I mean, I think Biden has threatened U.S. citizens or technological experts in China. If they don't quit their jobs immediately, they lose their nationality. So what? I mean, China has the technology themselves to continue working on it. They also have, as I said, the raw materials. Uh-huh. So I'm not so sure whether this is a real threat or just bluff.
Well, based on the reports, it is a real threat. And it's interesting that you talk about rare earths, because Hazeldin, China is not going to rule out not giving rare earths to the U.S., which would be a big catastrophe for the U.S. Exactly. In terms of the materials that are used that contain rare earths. But the mere fact that the U.S. wants to stop the advancement of another country in order for it to try to speed itself up and catch up, I guess that's one reason why the U.S. would do that. Or are we looking at the fact that China has passed the threshold in U.S.'s eyes when it comes to military prowess and strength, when it comes to hot-button issues, for example, Taiwan, which China has not ruled out using military force in terms of reunification? Of course, the U.S. has said we will defend Taiwan at the same time.
Well, I think
I'm sorry, Peter Koenig. This is for Hazeldin. Sorry, I'll get to you. Hazeldin, go ahead.
Yes, I think it speaks more to the more fundamental level of modernization and development of the productive forces that China has achieved – where now it's the United States which has to catch up with China. But the difference is, of course, that there was a time in which China felt like it had to catch up with the advanced countries and the Western world, and it did so by peaceful economic means, maneuvering its way through the complicated, you know, geopolitical and global political situation. The United States, in its attempt to catch up with China's level of not only technological advancement, but access to raw materials and resources and supply chains, can only do what it knows best and use political military force, rather than find some kind of cunning manner in the same way that China did to maneuver its way into catching up with China. The United States has to, I guess, achieve its economic goals at the barrel of a gun. And what it really speaks to as far as the United States' need to put China down and prevent China's development and growth is it's part and parcel with the United States' strategy, at least for the past few decades. The U.S. used to be the leader of global economic development, supposedly after the Bretton Woods period. Now the United States only seems like it can maintain its monopolistic position by directly halting and forestalling the development of other countries, whether it's through the IMF and their predatory loans, or through the use of military force to prevent other regional currencies from emerging, as we saw in the Middle East.
Well, Peter Koenig, in order to wrap our heads around what the U.S. wants to do with China, the facts should actually dictate the way we should see things. And that is, when you take a look at the way that China provides the types of goods that it does to countries around the world, it seems like it would just be very close to impossible for it to be taken out. Can't help but reflect on what the EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell actually stated on October 10th, saying that the EU prospered because it got cheap gas from Russia and it was able to get the cheap labor and goods from China, and it was able to prosper. So doesn't the U.S. approach towards China mean that it's going to hit a dead end? And also, at what cost? And of course, how China is going to react to U.S. aggression?
Well, yes, it's obvious. I mean that China has been for the last how many 20 years or maybe even more, a growing competition for the U.S. hegemony, and that is of course not acceptable for the U.S. Economy. I mean, the U.S. economy, basically right now, they can't supply anything that is competitive, not even replacement energy to the European Union after having forced them to cut off the gas stream from Russia. I mean, this is asking the European Union to commit suicide, which they obviously are ready to do. But on the larger scale, it's true. Of course, the U.S. cannot compete with anything that comes from China, and I think this is the long term. This is the threat and the long term fear that the U.S. has, that there will be eventually a unification of Eurasia, and Eurasia includes. I mean, it's the hugest continent of our Mother Earth. That would include about two-thirds of the world population, and China, Russia, India, and Pakistan, and all these countries are going to be part of it. And so, if this happens, and I mean that's a logical step because it's an non-interrupted area that would be economically so strong that there would be no other empire that could survive. And this is, I guess, the long-term threat that the U.S. perceives and wants to abolish, do away with Russia, and then as a next step or simultaneously China. That's where they're encroaching on both of these countries. Sure. So it's very clear, yes, the European Union, of course, itself could be a threat because they have 500 million people, they have a well-running economy. And if all the 27 countries would put their economic output together, they would have a larger GDP than the one of the U.S. And that's why the European Union was never allowed to become a federation, like a one-country federation like the United States of America.
Sure.
So this is very clearly the reason behind it.
Well, of course, the U.S. is trying everything it can in order to get the U.S. I'm sorry, get the European companies onto U.S. soil with the type of energy deals that it's offering, moving towards green energy. But Hazeldine, the South China Sea is another topic that China needs to deal with when it concerns the U.S. because the U.S. is in China's backyard and is trying to maneuver itself and get other countries in that region behind it. Now, the big question is, Xi Jinping obviously realizes that, and conveniently, Xi Jinping is also the leader of the military of China. So, conveniently, he can direct that approach, the militaristic approach, if required. Do you think that in his vision, after being reelected for the next 5 years, that that's on his agenda and something he's going to act on, given the fact that the U.S. will act on its aggression, which all sides are pointing to that?
Yes, I think China, while ramping up its military capabilities, is going to maintain a fundamentally defensive position. I don't think China has any ambitions to tip the scales in any drastic manner itself, though I do think it's preparing for the United States to act rashly, whether in the South China Sea or elsewhere. And I think that's really the linchpin of China's overall geopolitical and military strategy here. They're not necessarily looking to start any kind of conflict or fight, but they're definitely preparing and perhaps even expecting the United States to initiate one.
Okay, so when you say that, it's interesting because let's just dial back in time and go back to a month or so ago, where in a span of, I think, a week or 2 weeks, you had all these U.S. officials visiting the island. The most notable one was Nancy Pelosi, which in the beginning, there were speculations as to why she would go, because she would be next in line if something were to happen to Joe Biden after the VP, of course. But then we saw all these trips by U.S. officials. That was intense provocation. And we saw with China, how China reacted. And it was a military posturing that China took. So when you say that, that goes against what we just saw happen during that past weeks. So do you still think that would be the case, the defensive posture? Because that speaks of the old China. Maybe the new China in the next 5 years is not going to be like that.
Well, it should be. Oh, I don't know.
Okay, go ahead. Peter Koenig, to you.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Hazeldine. I'll get to you, though. Go ahead, Peter Koenig.
All right. What I think is happening, and I think President Xi was very clear on that, that he says he plans to peacefully integrate Taiwan into the mainland of China, and accent on peacefully. That is a priority because it's an internal affair. However, what he also said, that if there is foreign intervention in this process, then China would use the military. And I think this is very, very clear, and it's also very difficult from the South, from the South China Sea, where the South China Sea is a very largely disputed territory and disputed mostly by the U.S. because they want to encroach on China from all ends. And there it could be very different, that China is putting up military bases on some of the islands which it controls or pretends to control, and there the situation may be different. But I think fundamentally, I agree with my colleague, I don't think they changed their posture of becoming aggressive, but rather defensive, but being better prepared for such a defense than they have been maybe henceforth.
So what is the threshold, though? Tell us, if you can tell us, what line would the U.S. cross when it comes to, let's say, Taiwan, that it would require a reaction from China?
Okay. Well, I think that threshold or red line is has been made very clear. If Biden has said they will defend Taiwan at any time, if there's an active intervention in the case of, and I think that has already started, maybe clandestinely, not open to the public, sort of negotiations between Taiwan and mainland China. If there is an active intervention in this process by the U.S. or by anybody, by a proxy from Europe or somewhere else, then I think that would be the red line for China's military to intervene.
I see. So, Hazeldine, the economy obviously is something that China needs to deal with when it comes to not only the world, but also, of course, the U.S. that is trying to put a stick in the wheel, so to speak. Interestingly, when China rolled out the Belt and Road Initiative years and years ago, the U.S. did nothing really, but it came out through the G7 and offered its version of something to, I guess, counter the Belt and Road Initiative. It's called the Partnership for Global Infrastructure Investment. I don't know if you've heard of it, to mobilize $600 billion for middle and low-income countries.
Yes.
Well, it didn't really take off, Hazeldine. It hasn't really gone anywhere. And now we've gone through COVID, and now of course the Ukraine conflict. Do you think that was a very unsuccessful and big and significant failure on the part of the G7 to stand up to China's Belt and Road Initiative?
Oh, I mean, undoubtedly. You know, the devil is always in the details. I have no doubt that the United States and its so-called allies can commit as much money as they want to kind of try and rival China's Belt and Road Initiative. But what they don't have is the more overreaching strategy, as well as the details about which companies are going to be building this infrastructure, how are they going to do it, where are they going to do it. I don't see that global vision on part of the United States that can rival China's as far as what it expects in terms of increasing global economic interconnectedness, mobilizing using China's most intricate levels of economic planning, state-owned enterprises and infrastructure companies in partnership with other countries and governments. I think what the United States really lacks in that department is a solid level of win-win diplomacy, mutual understanding between partners rather than one domineering empire giving orders and commands to others. And even regardless, China has already, if I recall correctly, committed some $900 billion to the Belt and Road Initiative since it began in around 2013. So even then, if the United States has any intention of trying to rival China's Belt and Road Initiative, it's going to have to deal with two realities. First, it's going to have to dismantle the special relationships China has cultivated with its partners in the Belt and Road Initiative and somehow replace them. And then second, it's going to actually have to catch up in terms of, you know, reaching the level of progress that China has already since 2013. And given the state of economic crisis now plaguing the United States, and the internal political crisis within the United States, I just find that highly unrealistic.
Thank you. Thank you for that. We're fresh out of time. Peter Koenig, geopolitical analyst and former World Bank economist from Geneva. Hazeldine, thank you, political analyst and host at the Infrared Show from Detroit, Michigan. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tahlei and the team. It's goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.